So I'm here to introduce Sarah Hyde, who is an arts practitioner and counsellor in prisons and also kind of keenly interested in politics. And hopefully we're in for a really interesting next hour. So over to Sarah.
Thank you. Thanks so much, everybody, for coming. I had to try and keep an eye on the time. There isn't a clock, is there? I'm going to have my phone handy. I'm not texting my mates, just so you know. Live tweeting. I'm a bit scared. There's more people here than I thought. Hashtag GB40. Okay, so just to begin with, thank you for coming. And I do want to be just wondering about that person. Are we all right with this? If we shut the window, it's going to get hot. Yes. Lovely. It's always a solution to turn me up. I should be a bit louder, quite right. I'm doing all my jokes at the beginning. I'll try not to be flippant. So this is obviously quite a, serious subject matter. And so I want this to be a safe space for everybody, whatever your background is, whatever your personal experience of this is. So I'm going to do a bit of a trigger, what's known as a trigger warning. I don't believe in secondary or vicarious trauma, which can happen when someone gives you the unnecessary details of something like a violent sexual offence. But I will be giving you a few bullet points of specific situations that are a bit pertinent to the subject matter in my life. So that's the kind of arena that we're in. So this is your trigger warning. So keep yourself safe. If you need to leave at any point, feel free. You could be leaving to go to a different talk. None of us know. Keep yourself safe in this place, and let's be responsible to each other if there's times of dialogue or if we do a Q&A at the end, which hopefully, if I don't yang on too much, we can do. Great. So you've had a little bit about me professionally and a bit about me personally. My personal interest in this comes from when I was 16, a friend of mine tried to rape somebody. So this is where my interest in this subject matter began, and that's a dilemma of somebody I know doing something very seriously wrong that has stayed with me and has kind of led me to working in the criminal justice system, because this meant that someone who had committed a serious crime was no longer a stranger at the end of my arm, the other, they were my friend. And that has changed how I think and a lot of my life. And another story I'm going to allude to is somebody that was involved in my church community who was on trial for rape, and then how the journey of that. So that's a bit about my positionality. I'm not a survivor of sexual abuse. I think it's also really important for me to be upfront about that. That's not where I'm coming from. I have close family and friend relationships where this is a keen and live issue, but that is not my personal positionality. So there's a lot of this pain that maybe I can't fully comprehend, and I'm trying to do this talk with an open hand and wondering how in such a broken world we can work together to reduce victims and bring light, life, love and healing for everyone involved in these situations. So hopefully this can be a safe space, whatever your background, whatever your experience of this subject matter today. There are also some services that Greenbelt provide. There's a spiritual direction, there's pastoral care. If there's anything in this talk that you need to talk about with somebody afterwards and you haven't got a friend here, take care of yourself. Go and use the services Greenbelt have. Come and find me or the venue manager afterwards so we can signpost you on. Okay? Great. So I want to know about you before I start, to give me an idea. Can I get a feeling for how many people here work in the criminal justice system in some way, shape or form? Okay, not too many. That's great. It wouldn't matter if you were. I just want to pitch this at the right level. And obviously, I don't know how many people here work in women's services or work with survivors. That's another thing. Just to help me get a sense. Right, so can I be a feminist and be a friend of someone who's done something like commit the act of rape? Can I be a feminist who's friends with a rapist? I use that language really intentionally to provoke, because they're just nouns that we give people to help us understand the world. They're just one element of a very complex thing that we call a human being. I've grappled with this since I was 16, and I've kind of got a show in the making in my head that's just called My Friend the Rapist. I don't know if that's too controversial. I'm not sure if I'll ever make it. Because even when I talk about the title of that show with people, it elicits incredibly strong responses. And rightly so, because it's not something to take lightly. Before I really begin, we're going to look at the the situation that we're speaking to. So mainly, well, exclusively in this talk, I'm assuming that the perpetrator is male, which is not always the case, but the stats show that only 2% of sexual offending is carried out by women. That might be because of underreporting, but even allowing for a degree of underreporting, that's still quite low. So that's only 2% of sexual offending is carried out by women. In childhood abuse, girls are 6 times more likely than boys to be abused. So there's a bias where we expect the victim to be female, the perpetrator to be male. There are between 60 and 95,000 rapes that are reported in this country a year. And in terms of percentage-wise, I'm taking these stats from the Crime Survey of England and Wales. Out of all of those people, 57% of people told somebody that that had happened to them, but not the police. 15% of people told the police, and 28% told no one. So we've got a drastic underreporting situation, even when we are considering those numbers. And in 2011, there were 11,000 people in prison for sexual offences, which is about 14% of our current prison population. So that's the frame for what we're talking about. That's some of the stats. But what do we think about those people that have committed serious crimes and particularly serious sexual crimes? Okay, I don't know how people feel about standing up and moving around. Yay! Okay, great. So, I don't know if anyone's ever done a spectrum exercise. The idea is that this side of the room represents one thing, and this side of the room represents the opposite end of the spectrum. So, if people wouldn't mind standing up, and I'm going to read some statements that I would like you to respond to. Okay, the first statement that I'm going to read out is, I know a lot about sex offending, I've thought deeply about it and its prevention. If that is a true statement for you, can you go to this end of the room? And if that is a false statement for you, that end. And the idea is there's a spectrum line, so you don't have to be extreme. You can stand somewhere on the spectrum, totally. The middle is fine, anywhere. So I know a lot about sexual offending. I've thought deeply about it and its prevention. Great. It's all right. No one's judging you. Stand where you need to stand. It's fine. Now, I'm not going to pick on anybody, but are there any brave souls that are more down this end of the room which feel able to share? There's no pressure if no one wants to, but feel able to share why they've gone down this end. A work-related thing or a high person with your hand up?
Used to work in a rape crisis centre and with homeless men and women, so men who are rapists on one hand and women on the other hand.
Great, so if you couldn't hear that, as the lady who worked in a rape crisis centre working with men who are perpetrators often and women who are victims, so you've thought about that a lot. Is there somebody more in the middle who is feeling brave? Hi, lovely. Okay, so a lady who worked for Childline, got lots of training on how to talk to children in that situation, but that was a while ago, so you're feeling a little bit less sharp, perhaps. And the people way over by the tote pool, anyone feeling brave down that end? It's fine if you're not.
Yeah, you don't want to think about it.
Lovely. You don't want to think about it, so you don't. Quite true. Thanks for being really honest about that. Okay, number two, we're going to do a couple of these. Those who commit sexual offences should be chemically castrated. If you agree with that, can you go down this end of the room? If you disagree with that, can you go down this end of the room? So those who commit sexual offences should be chemically castrated. Again, this is a safe, non-judgmental space. I'm just going to keep saying that. Sorry, so chemical castration is where you have an injection or you are given drugs that prevent your hormones from functioning as they should. So it's not an actual physical castration, it's a castration via drugs that you're either given intravenously or by pill. Wow. Okay. Would you like to raise your hand if you want to state why your position is what it is on this one? Hi.
Works in rehabilitating those offenders, and that's a problem they've got to commit, create so many more victims.
Yeah.
And you know, and I think, is this an alternative to actually segregating and isolating them away?
Yeah. So chemical castration is an alternative to segregation because you've come from a children's social work background.
So I know about the cycle of abuse as
well. Yeah. Okay, thanks. So there's a brave soul down this end with their hand up.
Yeah, I was just thinking that it really depends who's driving that choice.
Whether right.
Whether that's the judicial system driving it or whether it's the individual making that choice themselves. That's my standing here because I think people should have agency to make that choice themselves if they want to.
Okay, so if it's self-directed, then that's fine. Anyone feeling brave down the other end? It's fine if you're not. Right, let's move on. And the final one is, I have nothing in common with people who commit sexual offences. If you think that is true, can you go down this? Sorry, leave now. If it's too much, feel free to leave, honestly. I get it. Because I work in prisons, I have to deal with stuff like dilemmas like this quite a lot. It's very live in my life, and I realise that this isn't most people's daily bread and butter, but it's mine, so welcome. Okay, I have nothing in common with people who commit sexual offences. If you think that is true, stand by the bar. If you think that is false, stand by the tote pool. And remember, the middle, you can stand anywhere on the spectrum. You don't have to be polarised in this. True or false? Yeah, again, it's, I have nothing in common with people who commit sexual offences. Clarify, okay, so true is by the bar, false is by tote. What I mean, on any level, I don't know, emotionally, spiritually, physically, motivationally... I'm talking about yourself. I'm talking about, how, if I had somebody here who'd committed a sexual offence and then you stood next to them, how similar do you think you are? Okay. And again, if anyone's feeling brave and wants to put their hand up and explain where they're standing, that'd be great. Yes, lady in front of me. Great, thank you. That's very clear. Anybody else feeling brave? Hello, down here.
I just think if we're being honest as Christians, we're all sinners.
If we're being honest as Christians, we're all sinners.
We may never have committed a sexual offence.
Yeah.
We've all lied. Cheated.
We've all cheated, yeah.
You know, so we should all say, that's what we've got in common. We're all sinners.
Yeah. So we're all sinners. That's what we've got in common. Okay, great. Thank you so much. Please do take a seat. You'll be relieved to know that's over. As you're going back to your seat, so I did that just to get us thinking about this for ourselves, and also to educate me on who was in the room, what the range of perspectives was. So there is a diverse range of valid perspectives on this. It's not straightforward. That obviously also illustrates that point too. Even at somewhere like Greenbelt, where we may be quite like-minded on quite a lot of stuff, that illustrates some of the perspectives and difficulty when you're grappling with these kind of questions that are around. So, there are two kinds of responses to some of these questions. I would say that they are what we do as individuals and what we do as society about a question like this. We are speaking, I read some statistics about the context we're speaking into, and I also would like to suggest that we live in a culture that loves a bit of blame and shame, that makes problems that of the individual, and that we need to look deeper at why that is. I don't think it's an accident. I don't think it's just where we are in history. I think there's a lot behind this punitive punishment agenda and the kind of late capitalist society that we're operating in that makes things about the individual and their problem. So understanding the wider narrative can help us begin to understand this debate and think, what is at work here in the way that perhaps the media report a lot of these stories, in our attitudes, in my personal response to these? Can we act as bridges, as people who are interested in things like issues of justice, fair treatment, love, Christianity? Can we act as bridges for people who are coming from a completely different space in the rest of our society? How do we win an argument for hearts and minds that says, like when the lady was stood down here and saying, we have all sinned. You know, we have all fallen short of the glory of God, if that's a verse that you subscribe to. How do we bring other people with us on that journey of seeking understanding and the levelling place of the cross? I work one-to-one with a lot of women, and I have to ask myself some difficult questions about that, because do I feed into a structure that says, this person has committed a crime and they need their behaviour modified in some way, rather than saying, what are all the other factors that make it so? Should I work with the individual and do offender management and behaviour modification? Or is it contingent on me and anyone else who works in the criminal justice system with individuals to also zoom out and say, what are these structures? What happened here? What built the system? Why is it so? So that's a discussion I've had with myself. How do you move the dominant discourse as well as writing and working with individuals? So let's think about these stereotypes that we have. If I say Daily Mail journalist, can you shout out some... Oh, I love that. Can you shout out some words that you associate with that?
Racist.
Racist.
Sensationalist.
Sorry?
Sensationalist.
Liar.
Highly professional.
Highly professional. Easy phrases.
Bullied.
Bullied. Great. Okay. So great. There we go. So we know...
Shedding light on real issues.
Shedding light on real issues. Okay.
Holding people to account.
So there's a kind of noun that some nouns that immediately bring things to mind. How about a counsellor or therapist?
Scary.
Scary. Okay, very good. That's honest.
Balanced.
Balanced, yes.
The tie-dye blouses.
Thank you. That's what I'm talking about. Thank you. Tie-dye blouses. Excellent. What about feminist?
Brilliant.
Thank you. Yes, that's right. Thoughtful. Scary.
Mixed bag.
Mixed bag. Broadchurch. Hairy. Not hairy. Those are some words I think of. And so I do that. I'm not going to do it with the word rapist or paedophile, but you get the idea. There are easy words, and language is important. And I would say this is one of the primary sites of resistance for us. When people say, oh, what can I do about people in the criminal justice system? What can I do without, you know, I'm a busy teacher, I'm busy working, I've got other things in my life. I think one of the primary things we can all do is be responsible in our use of language. So we're all at Greenbelt and we might think like this already, but what does it mean when we call somebody a rapist? How reductive is that about the complexity of human life when we call somebody a feminist, whatever the label is? I think we need to be much more careful about how we label people. And one of the leading resistance scholars in the country, Fergus McNeil, who writes about how people begin to desist from crime, has identified 8 steps for policy and practice for how this might work. And one of his steps is mind your language. He says, if the language that we use in policy and practice causes both individuals and communities to give up on the possibility of change and reformation, it confirms and cements the negative perceptions of people who have offended and their situations as risky, dangerous, feckless, hopeless, helpless, and it frustrates desistance. So something reifying, there's something cementing when we use that kind of language. We affirm that person's identity as a thief, a liar, a rapist, a feminist, whatever it is. So we need to mind our language in policy and practice. So I hate the term offender manager, because that makes that person permanently an offender and nothing else. That is their dominant way of being identified within a prison. I try not to talk about working with prisoners. I talk about people in prison. But sometimes I mess up, and I probably will during this talk. So what does it mean to use that one noun to sum somebody up? A feminist? A rapist? For ourselves, what are the public nouns that we use to describe ourselves? Daughter? Activist? And then there are probably private nouns that we use to describe ourselves. Because life is complicated. So I grew up in quite a feminist family. So I've been a feminist from an early age. We all went to the football. We all learned how to iron. I'm still terrible at ironing, but I think that's a nature-nurture thing. What is a feminist? What a feminist is a controversial topic in itself. Famously, it's been said that there is not a feminism, but there are many, many feminisms. So I'm not going to attempt to define it here. As the F Word website very astutely points out, it's impossible to define. There is no party line in feminism. There is no feminist rule book. Feminism in the UK today is whatever we make it. So I'm not going to devote too much time to defining feminism, but it is a broad church that we still need. And if anybody wants to know why, I really recommend a quick look at the older Everyday Sexism Twitter feed. So I grew up in a feminist household, so from an early age, that's something I identified with. And I got up to quite a lot of mischief then as a teenager. Other people might call it crime. I prefer to call it mischief. And I was in a hyper-privileged household where people loved me and reined in the worst of my excesses. So I'm going to call this story about my friend Stephen. It's not his real name, because I haven't seen Stephen for some years and I don't have his permission to tell this story. So I'm going to tell it from my point of view and use a different name. So he was a friend of ours. We went to sixth form college with him, and he was a really kind guy. He was the kind of guy that would always give you a lift home. He would always make sure that you were safe, and was generous and funny and sweet and doing his A-levels. And one day, after we'd all been out at a party the night before, the party was on Monday for my friend's birthday. You know those long summer holidays when you're still a teenager and you've got 6 weeks off, so you just have a party on a Monday. It was one of them. And then on the Tuesday, this awful thing happened. Stephen kidnapped one of our friends at knife point and tried to rape her. So I knew I was a feminist, and I knew he was my friend, but I knew that he'd as good as rape somebody, and I knew I was a human being, and I knew he was a human being, but I still knew that he'd tried to rape somebody, and I couldn't square the circle in my 16-year-old mind. And lots of boys in our group started kicking off and giving it all that, oh, I'm going to cut his thing off, I'm going to go and stab him, he's got to watch himself. And lots of the girls were going, oh, that could have been me. What do we do about that? So we drank lots of vodka and talked a lot in response. But we knew him as a loving human being, and it didn't fit the picture. And it was really problematic. And I'd grown up in a really safe home, very privileged home, and so I had no context for this. You know, I'm very fortunate. This was my first experience of something like this, but I didn't know what to do with it. And this incident has changed my life. It's kind of fundamentally why I work in prisons, because I had a profound revelation of a human doing something awful rather than this person is the doer of awful things. Oh, they might be someone's child, maybe. You know, they might be someone's husband or wife. Because my primary mode of knowing this person was as my friend. And so what do you do as a feminist then? What kind of feminism allows for friendship with those who rape people? Bell Hooks, who's one of my favourite intersectionalist feminist heroes, she's a black feminist in America, says this: "For me, forgiveness and compassion are always linked. How do we hold people accountable for wrongdoing and yet at the same time remain in touch with their humanity enough to believe in their capacity to be transformed?" And that tension goes on in my work. How do you hold people accountable for their wrongdoing, because these are absolutely imprisonable offences, and yet at the same time remain in touch with their humanity enough to believe in their capacity to be transformed? So how do we identify as a feminist or as a human being to another human being with people that have committed serious crimes? There's an issue of othering. I talked a bit about blame and shame at the beginning. There's an idea often that in our society, when somebody does something wrong, they're at the end of my finger. I am pointing at you. This distances me from you, the wrongdoer, which is why I got us to stand on that line and have a think about, how much do I have in common with people who've committed serious offences? How much do I think, yeah, I am like them? Maybe I think, even when I'm using this, them, what's that? Sorry. I other, even with all my kind of thinking about this, I'm doing an othering right now. I'm saying, how do you think about them? I'm making that person not like me. I want you to know I'm separate from that. I don't do that. And I think one of the ways through this is embracing the similarity of our humanity and looking for bridges to build and points of connection. Wendy Brown says, an enemy is someone whose story you haven't heard. And I've only worked in one prison that is explicitly for sex offenders. And some of the stories I heard in my short time working there explained a lot to me. And that doesn't justify anything. And it doesn't mean those people shouldn't be in prison. but it gave me a more profound understanding about the level of damage that had been done and then the damage that those people had done to others. And it made me think about this whole thing again in a completely different way. So in this culture of blame and shame, how do we build a bridge between maybe some of the accepting people at Greenbelt and some of the harsher faces in the world at large? So I saw a client in prison recently, and we were chatting, and she's on remand for quite a serious offence, and she said all this stuff about some other people, like blame, 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 blame. And then she said, to be honest, though, I can be a right C word. I'm not going to say it. And I said, yeah, but isn't that what it is to be human? I'm going to substitute the C word with the word nightmare, just for cleanliness sake. I just thought, isn't that what it is to be human? Isn't that true of all of us? We're basically like this incredible mixture of beloved, precious, amazing, uniquely created human beings who are like complete nightmares at other times, or complete C words, at other times. And part of a way through the shame and blame of others is to begin to dwell in the acceptance of our own perfection, our own ability to do ill, the complexity of good and evil all at once in human form. So I can't make somebody else... Oh, sorry, backtrack. So there's a difference, I think, between guilt and shame. Guilt happens when you traverse your personal boundaries. I don't need anybody else to tell me that I've done something wrong. I steal something. I've gone outside my personal boundaries. I experience guilt. It's a sharp, specific conviction related to an action. It's very useful. I think the Holy Spirit uses it all the time. For me, shame is about other people. Did somebody see me do that terrible thing? Do they know about that awful thing I did? Will they ever love me if they know the truth about me and how hideous I am? Shame says you are a mistake rather than you've made some mistakes. And that's why language and how we use it is so important. So one way I think through this and how you begin to build bridges and make a society where people maybe can come back from something like committing a sexual offence is to own our own shame. To acknowledge that we are precious nightmares. Otherwise we end up in this lopsided, do-gooding kind of Victorian philanthropic model with a really bad power dynamic where we're going in like the cavalry to help people rather than saying, actually, I'm a precious nightmare. I'm going to own my crap and be vulnerable in front of you. I can't make somebody else more vulnerable. I can make myself more vulnerable, and I can create the conditions, therefore, where someone else might be too. Brené Brown, if anyone knows her from TED Talks and life in general, is a researcher who's done lots of work on shame and vulnerability. And she talks about the antidote to shame. She talks about courage, the courage to be imperfect, telling the story of who you are with your whole heart. She talks about being compassionate, first to yourself and then to others. And what a truth is that, if that we can't be compassionate to ourselves and own our imperfections and say, that's okay, how on earth do we expect to expend compassion and allow others to be imperfect too? Perfectionism kills. Connecting, letting go of who you think you should be so that you can be who you are. So courage, compassion, and connecting. Numbing our own pain doesn't work because we can't selectively numb it, which is what perfectionism does. It's what controlling behaviours do. It's what overeating does. It's what alcohol does. We are all probably engaged in some degree of behaviour that is about numbing and covering our shame. So what can I do about people in our society that are committing sexual offences without getting a whole new job and a new life? Number one, mind your language. Number two, let's start to own our own shame and start to work at being more vulnerable. Empathy is the antidote to shame. Unconditional love is the antidote to shame. And I think we have more in common with sex offenders than maybe we think. We need to get out of these lockages of shame. And human connection is what does that. When you say to somebody, I did this awful thing, I do it, it's an addiction, it's a habit, and they say, that's okay, the thing you did is not okay, but I love you, and let's work on this together, it enables greater vulnerability So there's something about human connection that unpicks shame. Responses can't heal shame, but human connection can. When someone's pouring out their heart to you about their childhood abuse or about a terrible addiction they have, there's nothing you can say, probably, to make that much better unless you're highly trained in that area, but you can offer them love and a good word of human connection. So I don't believe that clever responses can heal shame. I believe that relationship and human connection can. Just say, I'm going to sit with you in this shit. Because this is what we're talking about. We're talking about death experiences and shit. And sitting with somebody in that is one of the most powerful things you can do, because they can be vulnerable and you allow them to be, and you meet that vulnerability with love. So, Precious Nightmares. One of my favourite writers, whose name I can't pronounce, Solzhenitsyn, sorry you Russian scholars, said this. If only it were all so simple. If only there were evil people somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But the dividing line between good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. And who is willing to destroy a part of his own heart? So I return to this again and again, the truth of our human condition, where we are precious nightmares, because we long to be accepted just as we are and not have people's judgment on us. So part of breaking free of the society of blame and shame is to own our shame, make vulnerability okay, to say, I am enough. So capitalism tells me that there is never enough. Our whole society is geared to more stuff and more of me and more better me. And actually, you are enough. Jesus says, you are enough because of me. So these are crimes that fracture and invade the self. How do you... What if one of these people is your friend, or you start mentoring somebody? If you become involved in a brilliant initiative like Circles of Support. Circles of Support work with people coming out of prison through the gate and create loving communities to try and prevent reoffending. So they do risk assessment on the offender's needs, on the victim's needs, and the community's needs. Because what triggers recidivism, there's many factors, but social isolation and loneliness are really high up. Because understandably, when somebody who's on the sex offenders register comes out of prison, people don't rush to meet them, by and large. You know, they might have offended against their own family. That's gone. You know, everyone in their community's heard about it. They can't live there. It's not safe. So how do we come in with the stuff that breaks shame, that breaks loneliness, and meet these people to reduce recidivism? Because this is what this is about. We want damaged people to not create more damage. Sorry, I've just lost myself. Yeah. What do we do with people who are very damaged and have caused a lot of other damage to other people? If you have got time and are interested in this work, I do really recommend that you look up an organisation like Circles of Support, that you look up Caring for Ex-Offenders, that you look up Basic Caring Communities that is run by PACT. But something that's really stayed with me from... my other friend who I spoke about at the beginning. My friend who we're going to call Phil, who is from my local community, who was picked up on a rape charge. And I went to his court case. It was a Crown court case, these things are. And I did it, there was about five of us who were supporting him. So somebody different went every day. So we didn't all have to be in court every day, because it's not a very nice thing to listen to. And at the time, I was making a show with another girl, and she just said to me, how can you do that as a feminist? Is it not great against you to go and support him? And I said, oh, I think being for humans is maybe more important than any label I could give myself. And then tellingly, I spoke to somebody else in the week following his trial, and she just said, I couldn't do it, I couldn't be there. And I said, that's all right, that's why we do this stuff as community, right? She said, yeah. And the reason that she couldn't be there is because she'd endured years and years of sexual abuse at the hand of her father, and then has had many domestically violent and sexually abusive relationships consequently. So she couldn't be there for this man. But I could, and other people could, because that was not our story. So the third thing, after the naming, after the owning our own shame, is that we've got to do this in community. We have got to do this with other people, because there are people in all of our lives and all of our circumstances, it is not their gig to meet someone who's committed a sexual offence coming out of prison. It is not their gig to be in a small support group. But that's okay, because although the rates of sexual abuse are very high, as many as 1 in 4 for childhood abuse, that means 3 out of 4 of us can turn up. We can be there, we can participate, we can support. So I haven't been very involved after this guy's conviction with his support, but I do. He has a wife who lives in a different country, and I email her, because that's the best way for me to provide ongoing support to that situation. So it's about doing, there are other people who do go and visit, who are very, very involved still with him, but I'm at one step removed, partly because of the conflict, and partly because you have to know what your gig is. What is my gig in this community? What's the bit that I can do well and consistently and helpfully? So, do this in community. We have a relational God. We can do it together. And shalom and the new kingdom that's breaking in is relational, but not everything is everybody's job. So what can we all do to love people well and have less victims of serious crime? Let's be honest about our shame and begin to address it so we can be truly vulnerable, making it easier for other people to be vulnerable too. We can mind our language. The words we speak are full of meaning. Let's not bandy around terms like prisoner, offender, rapist, paedophile anymore. We can, 3, place ourselves in profound community where there is enough care for everybody to go around. This is complicated stuff. If you're in church leadership, you might know if you've got sex offenders in your congregation, because there's a register and there's disclosures that the authorities make to keep people safe. This might be a very live issue for people in this room. We have got a responsibility to create a safe place in church for everybody, so that children are safe, so that vulnerable adults are safe, so that people who want to live differently are safe and have the opportunity to do so. 4, which I haven't spoken about yet, but I'm going to end on this, and this is about dispelling our own personal shame. We've got to let our God love us, because we don't need to rescue other people. We need to know that we are enough, and then we can give out of a place of abundance. In all of this, boundaries are massively important, because many people who work in social justice, criminal justice, caring professions are dashing in there like somebody's saviour, like the rescuer. That's up to Jesus. And in myself, I've identified recently, I have quite a lot of codependent relationships. I'm hyper responsible for, you know, I meet someone on the street who's crying, that's only my problem. And they're my new best friend, and if I don't fix them quick, I'm glad that you don't know me, because there's probably some people who know me really well who are internally cracking up. Boundaries in all of this is massively important, and we need to eschew codependency and call it out and say, hang on a minute, who's this about? Is this about you or the other person? Why are you taking so much responsibility? Why do you need to be needed? What is going on there? It's about being in it together and being honest. So that last point again is let our God love us, because then we don't need to rescue others. We know that we are enough. And we give out of a place of abundance. I'm going to finish with a prayer that somebody gave to me. And it's kind of about dispelling shame. It doesn't mention that. But I really believe that unless we're honest about where we are, we can't even begin to worry about anybody else. Okay. It's called Let Your God Love You. Be silent. Be still. Alone, empty, before your God. Say nothing. Ask nothing. Be silent. Be still. Let your God look upon you. That is all. God knows. God understands. God loves you with an enormous love. And God only wants to look on you with that love. Quiet, still, be. Let your God love you. Amen. Thank you. So we can do a bit of a Q&A, but I'm also... there's lots of people here that have obviously got relevant work experience. So if we do a Q&A and you've got an A, put your hand up. Yeah. Is that all right? I don't know if anyone wants to ask any questions or if you're going to have a lie down. But
this is a little cross-cultural question. Mm. I'm Australian and my husband is Greek-Australian and we're both Anglican ministers. And my husband's family are Greek Orthodox. Very culturally Greek, like a typical migrant family that came to a new land in the 50s. My husband's sister, a Christian, now in the Anglican Church, married an Australian man. His family has, as it turns out, a very strong line of men who abuse children, and our family weren't aware of this. And as it's transpired, his brother has been in prison. And their daughter, who's our niece, at 14, went to the school counsellor and said her dad had been abusing her for 4 years. Gosh. Christian family. Yeah. My husband's Greek family's response is, he's done something wrong, but economically we need him to be the father of that household. And relationally... we blame the wife and the daughter because obviously that man wasn't being satisfied.
Excellent, yeah.
And we just close ranks and we carry on. Mm. Meanwhile, we're in England while all of this is happening. Mm. And it's just been very hard to engage with our brother-in-law, whom we love, to acknowledge that he's done this. We find that very hard. To care for our sister, niece and nephew, our own children, our own wider Christian community, and also to have a cross-cultural element where you're dealing with other ways of seeing. I'm not quite sure what the question is.
Well, I would just, just with my professional head on, I think you have I'm not going to tell you what to do, but in your shoes, I think you have a duty of care to that child to report that to the relevant authorities. I'm just going to say that straight away. Oh, he is in prison. Okay, right, great. Sorry, just to be really clear about that, because disclosure is very serious, and if we tolerate that at any level, we allow it. So anyway, I don't know the individuals involved. I don't know your family, but I would ensure that you have good support for dealing with that situation. If you know people on the ground that can get around them and be involved, because actually presence, I think, is really important. And so if there's other people as well that you can draft in that situation, I would endorse it. And I would encourage honest dialogue around this wherever you can, because that's obviously a massive issue that people just do not talk about this. And the stats show that it's really rife in our society. And we're all walking around with these shame-based behaviours and abuse-based behaviours in a lot of cases, but no one's talking about it. We just go, oh, she's got OCD, oh, she's a bit controlling, oh, she's always depressed, oh, she overeats, oh, blah, 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 blah. And actually, that's because of this. And we're not talking about it. And we're not talking about the wider effects and the dysfunctional society. So look after yourselves so that you can be good supports and try and provide support for them in situ and use it as an opportunity to discuss if you can bear it, because it's so painful. Is that... I don't know if that's in any way helpful. You can... Oh, there's a lady in green who's stood up.
Okay, It wasn't really a question, but it was a very quick point.
Yes, please.
Which is, number one, this is the only talk that I will probably get to, and I'm so glad that I chose this one because I think you've got right to the heart of what's important about Greenbelt and about life generally.
Okay,
two, by coincidence, I'm married to the guy who organises circles of support for the whole of the Southwest, and we are running a stall in G-Source.
Excellent.
And he has just won a lottery grant, so there's a lot of money.
Brilliant.
All you lovely volunteers to come and talk to him.
Brilliant.
And we are just ordinary people, and we had a friend who committed a sexual offence, and that's what started us on that road. So
brilliant. Thank you for sharing that. That's really valuable. Thank you.
My colleague at church said that she wouldn't support the NSPCC because they took the line that people can't change.
Mm-hmm.
But the contrary is that many offenders against children will not change short of a total supernatural act by God.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be a fair comment, that it can be a disease in some people, that they will always have that proclivity?
Yeah, well, I think it's really complicated, and the more... It's really complicated, and everyone's an individual. And the more, there's research that shows if you've committed more than one sexual offence, your recidivism rate really kind of goes up. So that suggests, one of the factors is potentially situational. And so that suggests that for some people it's a kind of one-off behaviour, but that isn't the majority. So I think that's why these conversations around things like chemical castration are quite interesting. How we imprison, we've got a massively ageing prison population. And actually, because of, in the wake of things like Jimmy Savile, and even before that, people are starting to talk about this more as a society. So a lot of our ageing prison population who are 50 plus are in there for sexual offences that maybe were committed a long time ago now. So it is a live problem. But I don't want to be ignorant and dippy about it, but I think Jesus can do anything, otherwise I'm going home, basically. Like, the cross either does it or it doesn't. So with the big caveat of these are very, very damaged people with massively entrenched behaviours in some cases, I have to believe that there's hope for everybody, and that might only come in heaven and not on this earth, because statistically it doesn't look good, but I think that's probably because we haven't found the right way of working with people on release. Something like circles of support is a start for that. I don't know if somebody with more knowledge on this topic than me wants to chip in. Have you got an A? Or Q? Go on. I would love to hear it. No, say it.
Like I said before, I'm a social worker, so I see the amount of damage which is done by... I'm a social worker and I see the amount of damage which is done by these people.
Yeah.
I believe we all come from difficult backgrounds, and we're not all complete in any way from the day we're born, even through the best parents. Getting on to the point, people have committed sexual offences. When they're in prison, I agree with all the support which you're saying should be available, you know. But at the point before they're released, they should be able to realise that what they've done is wrong, not just not illegal, but morally wrong. And that should be well before the sentence end it, so then they can look in terms of how can they prevent themselves reoffending again. And I don't think when they're actually released, most of them are capable of making the decision of actually being able to not reoffend again, rather than responsibility of everybody else. So this is where I think deprivation of liberty is necessary, whether it's chemical castration or segregation, unless they can see, right, it's wrong, I want to actually change.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I'm going to try and do. This is a support which I'll need.
Mm-hmm.
Unless they can actually do that, I've got to think, I just don't think that they're capable, and they need support, which may not just be about loving and caring, but actually physical deprivation of liberty.
Yeah, no, I think there's...
I think that's to help them.
Yeah, I think it plays a really important role. I agree with custodial sentences, and I'm interested in the chemical castration debate. My brain's just gone blank. I was like, also, I've completely lost my point. Okay, it might come back to me. Sorry. I won't, yeah.
Somebody else should do.
No, I agree. But that's why we have things like license conditions or conditions. Like some of the people I work with, they had conditions that meant they could never be around children ever again unsupervised, and that is quite right. So there's lots of measures sometimes when people are on sex offenders registers that they have to subscribe to, and that is right and good, because we should not be providing any opportunity for people to reoffend. I also think I can only be responsible for myself and how I react, so I can't make somebody change. And I think you're also right in that people rationalise their offences away a lot, and I wonder about the role of something like restorative justice explicitly with sex offenders, where you go, this happened, let's look at the damage, this happened, and you did this, and it doesn't denigrate your humanity, you are a human being worthy of love, but you did this, and let's have a look at what that actually means, because then you might get to a place where on release people have grappled with that, because it is a big problem if people are getting out and they're like, la la la, that didn't happen, that's not okay, and you're right. Sorry, I went on a bit.
I just want to make a comment in regards to your use of language and the importance of that. And from my experience, both, as I've said, working in homelessness, where we had a lot of sexual offenders mm-hmm. who came through because they had nowhere to go. Mm-hmm. And then mm-hmm. they'd be stuck with us for mm-hmm. months and months and potentially years because they couldn't be placed anywhere where there was children or where there were women mm-hmm. or where mm-hmm. they were in potential situations. But they were always labelled with, oh, you're a rapist, oh, you're a paedophile. Mm-hmm. But their situations were often very different. Some mm-hmm. of them committed really heinous things, mm-hmm. Really awful sort of mm-hmm. repetitive mm-hmm. Nature, and you're going, okay, this person's mm-hmm. not safe. Mm-hmm. But then I think of particularly one man who had learning disabilities, mm-hmm. and his partner had learning disabilities, and there was a big question over whether she mm-hmm. said no or not. And so in Scots law, that's rape. Mm-hmm. And it is rape. Mm-hmm. And he didn't understand what he was doing. Mm-hmm. But he's on sex offense register mm-hmm. and he can't. So to say this man's a rapist, this is to deny that this man had any other mm-hmm. aspect to him. Mm-hmm. You know, to deny his sense of humor, deny his loving nature, his trusting nature, mm-hmm. which is not to say he didn't do something completely wrong and violate that woman. But I remember seeing him come in and he was beaten up by guys on the streets because his ex-girlfriend had managed to tell everybody, oh, he's a heinous, horrible, awful person. And he mentioned mm-hmm. the R word. And he comes back, and we had to phone the ambulance because they just didn't see him as a human being. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a difficulty in putting people on the register, because it could be that you were a 17-year-old boy going out with a 15-year-old girl. Mm. Parents don't like you. Off, you know, you get done for statutory rape, and that's you for the rest of your life. So we do have to be really careful about saying this person is evil.
They have
done something evil. But that doesn't mean that there is not redemption. And I think that's, you're right, this is the only way that we have miracles, but
we've got to be savvy.
We have to be savvy.
There's two things there. I'm really glad that you raised that. Firstly, something I forgot to say was, unlike other offences where statistically people from very poor socioeconomic backgrounds and there's a kind of prevalence of poverty driving a lot of crime, sexual offenders are from every sector of society and are more racially representative of the rest of the population of the UK. And that is our teachers, our vicars, our university professors, our friends. It's very, very different when you look at the kind of demographic and socioeconomic breakdown of sexual offenders. The first point. The second point is, there's a whole other debate about whether we believe in the sex offenders register. I do, but maybe not as it exists right now.
We've probably got time
there's
for just
this
one.
This lady's been really, I don't know what she's going to say, but I feel like she's...
I think this is going to be the last question, if that's okay.
Sorry. Can I come...
Yeah, I was just really interested in your comments about language, and I definitely take your point. I was just wondering what you thought of the way sexual offences are reported in the media.
Mostly, do you know what? Because I work with women mainly, I've mainly thought about this in relation to cases where children have been killed or abused. And when I haven't been working very long with women in prison, and the Baby P case happened. And I went in one day and there was the headline of the Mail or whatever, a paper that said monster. And it had this picture of Tracy Connolly's face, who was Baby P's mum. And the woman who was my boss at the time said to me, have you seen that? Funny, she looks just like a woman to me. And that has just really stayed with me. Because sometimes the articles, when you dig deeper, maybe aren't as bad. And actually, I read this article in the Daily Mail that's very interesting about Baby P's mum, and it told the whole of her childhood backstory, which is, like, unbelievably tragic. And then at the end of the article, it says, but still, she did this really. And I was like, Really? Because you've really delicately delved into her past and given me an understanding of this woman I didn't have, and still at the end it was very pejorative and had to whip it up and had to make it about blame, because she did do something hideous. And it doesn't, just because you seek to understand something doesn't make it okay, you know. And I think we have a really punitive press. And in 1993, we had about 41,000 people in prison. We now have twice that in 20 years. Our prison population has doubled. But the British Crime Survey tells me that crime is down. But that is partly because of a punitive media that whip up punitive policy and longer sentencing. So I do think the media could be a lot more responsible. But that's why I think things like the arts or us as people making connections and building bridges is really important, because then you start to change hearts and minds, and people might not look for that in a newspaper and might boycott it or write to the editor when language like that is used.
But I wonder, sort of, perhaps sometimes, like a slightly sensationalist tone, maybe sensationalist is possibly the wrong word, but in a way that will kind of draw attention to something. I mean, look, all the horrific cases in Rochdale, and like that was years and years of investigative reporting, and that would never have come to light. And sometimes you need to do that. You need to kind of, you know, draw people's attention to it. So look, you know, look is what's happening. Look what, you know,
some brilliant, very responsible journalism around some of this stuff. But there's also, but it's not to rubbish all journalists, sorry. Are we TikTok? People are shifting.
Yeah,
there's a lady there. Maybe
we do need to finish. Okay, there will be a few moments if people want to approach you and just chat to you for a few moments. Can we give a Greenbelt appreciation for Sarah, please?